this is Bill Indicky for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in Minnesota. The podcast this week is a conversation with Bob Roscoe, a friend of mine and a Minneapolis architect, activist, and author who wrote the book on Milwaukee Avenue. The book's called Milwaukee Avenue, Community Renewal in Minneapolis. And if you didn't know about it already, Milwaukee Avenue is one of the most unique streets in the city. It's a three-block-long stretch of historic working-class homes in the Seward neighborhood. The homes were saved from urban renewal demolition and converted to a pedestrian-only street back in the 1970s. That's really interesting for a couple of reasons. They didn't often preserve working-class homes, more like the fancy homes, and then there's almost no pedestrian-only streets in residential neighborhoods in the city. So it's a really interesting space if you haven't been there. Anyway, I sat down and talked to Bob about it. He was one of the main people working on preserving that space back in the 70s. Since then, he spent many years sort of doing a career around preservation, architecture, and even some photography. You might call it ruin photography, around historic urbanism in the Twin Cities. Really interesting guy, and we sat down the other day at the Seward Cafe, which is only two blocks from Milwaukee Avenue, to talk about sort of urbanism and preservation from the 1970s, what makes Milwaukee Avenue unique, and what urbanists, all you kids out there, can learn from the older generation of activists who are interested in urban design, which is also a really interesting topic. We got to that at the end of our conversation. I hope you enjoy this. Welcome to the Streets.mn podcast. I'm here with Bob Roscoe. Bob, you wrote the book on Milwaukee Avenue and the history of Milwaukee Avenue in Minneapolis' Seward neighborhood. You're also an architect, because I see you have drawings here.
Right.
And maybe you could just introduce yourself for the audience.
I've done a lot of architectural work since the early 70s when this project started. And I'm not a registered architect, but I've had a lot of architecture school. I've been through a lot with historic preservation issues and others, so I know what I'm doing. I work with registered architects very occasionally, but the work here was required, I think, a certain amount of really understanding of how communities work and how to outthink a bureaucracy, because that was most of the job. When we finally worked the community group, the Seward West Project Area Committee, we started about 1972, and the 35-block area was called Seward West Urban Renewal Area, was scheduled to be demolished. The neighborhood, as compared to East Seward has been a middle-class neighborhood. It went through renewal before what was then called Seward West area, and they basically did remodeling. I didn't say rehabilitation. Rehabilitation hadn't been invented yet. It waited for Seward West before the term rehabilitation, which is a thorough remake of houses. Which is what was required with the houses in Seward. Seward West had been a working class neighborhood. Parts of it we might call middle class, and it's kind of pointless to talk anymore about trying to distinguish those two.
Well, can we actually describe where Seward is located in Minneapolis's sort of landscape? To me, Franklin Avenue, which sort of defines one of the boundaries of Seward, was the border of the city way back in like 1880, maybe?
In 1880 it was.
Yeah, and so a lot of the houses that were built around here, it's sort of on the edge of an industrial area. It's also close to the river. It's about a mile and a half from downtown, I would say.
About a mile and a half. No more than a mile and a half, and sure.
How old are most of the buildings in this neighborhood, in both these neighborhoods?
In Seward West, it was a little bit older. Some of them started... A few started in the late 1870s, and the others were built pretty much in the 1880s and early 90s. And then That's in the Seward West. Seward East, being a little bit further away from the city core, even though the streetcars ran there too, it took a little bit longer for that area to kind of get built. That's sort of like a turn of the 20th century area, very late 19th century and then early 20th century houses.
Yeah, and I'd say most of the housing stock is, I'd say, small, well, single-family and duplex-type houses that have a lot of ornate porches and beautiful woodwork and stuff like that. But they weren't really fancy mansions, I guess. They were sort of middle-class housing, I would guess. I don't know. What do you think?
In eastern part of Seward, they were middle-class, but typical Midwestern practicality. There wasn't a single mansion or any house close to it. People would have been afraid to make their house look like they were better than everybody else. That was a Scandinavian way. So the houses were prim and basic, and just enough ornamentation to give them a little bit of self-respect, the houses. In Seward West, the working class houses were put together the best way they could, and they often lacked ornamentation. Sometimes there was just a small amount of it. This is on the exterior now. On the interior, a lot of these houses had fairly ornate woodwork in terms of door and window casing with 4.5-inch wide door trim, and then what's called corner blocks at the top corners, and then the horizontal headpiece. And I think that's because the Minneapolis being such a center for bringing lumber down the Mississippi River from the northern forest, that there are plenty of mills in parts of northeast Minneapolis, and then where the post office is now and upriver from there. So it was fairly easy to do trim that is actually quite costly today.
Yeah. So I guess let's zoom in on the Milwaukee Avenue area then. So when did that get built? And then maybe you can describe sort of what happened in the 60s and 70s that in this neighborhood that before, like you said, it got turned around or rehabilitated.
Milwaukee Avenue started off as it originally was platted out like typical blocks in South Minneapolis, twice as long running north to south as they were wide running east to west. But a real estate speculator named William Reagan showed up from wherever he came from, and William Reagan wanted to make a lot of money. He needed to make a lot of money because he gambled a lot.
That's kind of normal back then, though.
It was normal. And then, of course, wherever he gambled, he made sure there was plenty of liquor around to help him out. So he came up with this very unorthodox idea of taking the alley that had been running in a north-south direction from Franklin to East 24th Street. He moved it off-center, and then he decided to widen it just a little bit. And then he built houses right up to the sidewalks that bordered this now street that he called 22nd and a half Avenue. And it was quite narrow, 25 feet wide or less. And this allowed him to, in essence, build what it would look like houses along an alley, but it wasn't an alley because it was a very narrow street. So what Reagan did is, and then the houses were quite small, 22 feet in width, and the lots were real narrow. They were zero lot line on the north side and maybe about 15 feet on the south side. Some lots were even more narrow than that. And so he doubled his investment by doubling the amount of houses that could be built in the two blocks that now became four blocks, in essence.
And that was kind of unique back then, I guess. How did he get this idea? Who knows? This guy, you know, probably just had a drunken, brilliant moment or something.
It's probably based on mathematics, as far as I know, and now it's historic preservation. Go figure.
Yeah, it kind of shows you that a lot of this stuff is sort of arbitrary that we decide is really, I mean, I guess to me it says that things that we preserve and value are often not as sacred as we imagine them to be. You know, like Fauché Tower is, that was a similar sort of just almost bamboozlement, you know, that created that building, but now it's almost an accident, but it's beautiful and we do value it, you know. The same's true of the Milwaukee Avenue story.
That's a good comparison, Bill. With the Fauché Tower, that story has been told. Part of it that you'll hear, if you hear enough of the story, is that Fauché, who built it, filed for bankruptcy on the day of its opening. But with back to Milwaukee Avenue, which is a mile and a quarter away from the Fauché, what Reagan decided to build, and this is the thing that is really highly interesting and what really makes what Milwaukee Avenue is now. Most of the houses, about two-thirds of the 46 houses that line the street, are brick. And brick was a common material then. There weren't brick unions like there are today. There's a lot of brick that was made along the riverbanks in North Minneapolis. But it still was more expensive. And he decided that these houses should have some very lacy Queen Anne porches. And that, it almost seems extravagant for workers' housing, because that's what it's intended for, is for workers who worked on the nearby Milwaukee Railroad that was just about 300 feet from the southern end of what's now Milwaukee Avenue.
Yeah, like one thing to remember is I've seen old maps of this area, and where the light rail stuff is now was a big rail yard, right?
Yes.
And a lot of their old rail yards in Minneapolis are gone now.
They're all gone, even the Shoreham Yards in northeast Minneapolis off Central Avenue. That's practically all gone. And the Milwaukee Railroad Yards, as I said, that's just between Milwaukee Avenue and Lake Street, was quite a large yard. A lot of switching trackage, roundhouse, a lot of buildings that repaired locomotives, and it employed a lot of people. And then what that railroad yard did, too, that was pretty interesting, like a railroad yard that size, means that there's little foundries and other kinds of little supply sheds and so on that are like the subcontractor, so to speak, that fed the railroad business. And, of course, they fed the other machine shops and what are other industries that stretched south of Lake Street, along Hiawatha and Mihai Avenue. So this was quite an industrial area. And a lot of the workers who lived in Seward West, and most of them who lived on Milwaukee Avenue, worked in those industries. And that's where Milwaukee Avenue got its name, from the Milwaukee Railroad. And when we started to do our urban renewal research, before we wanted to tell the Housing Authority what they could do with their plan, where they could stick it, we had heard the lore of the people who lived on Milwaukee Avenue. A lot of the older people who lived there then maybe moved in there in the 20s. So they still had live family members, older members, who were here from the beginning. And the lore got to be that it was built for Milwaukee Railroad workers. Now, that turned out not to be true, because when Jerry Niedenfuhr did historic research, she really couldn't find much documentation for that. I'll just pause there for now.
Yeah, it's like, but it was for people who worked in many of the industries in the area, right? It didn't necessarily have to be for the railroad company, but in general, I'm kind of curious about So a lot of that railroad yard probably started closing down in the 70s, probably, maybe earlier than that, and then a lot of the sort of the way that the freeway came in 1965 or so, along just north of here, and in general, I think the neighborhood was getting decrepit, you know, or the houses were falling into disrepair, and then.
Yeah, there's three things that kind of happened there, Bill, from your remarks. There were, in Seward West, there were a lot of mom-and-pop grocery stores. Every block had at least two of them. And in some cases, gradually, all of those little mom-and-pop grocery stores, at some point they hung on because they couldn't afford to go out of business. The railroad was in the same position. They hung on for some reason. They thought that they could lose money and still hang on and keep their operations, but gradually, by the 1970s, probably before then, I didn't come here till 70, but they started to decline. And by the time we started the Milwaukee Avenue project in 72, and we finished maybe in 82, 10 years or so, and the railroad had largely declined by then. I think by 82, the last building, there was just one building left.
Yeah, and so describe what this area was like in 1972 when the Milwaukee Avenue project got started.
It was really interesting. My wife and I lived in St. Paul in an apartment building, and I grew up in Brainerd, Minnesota, and came here in 1960, and part of Brainerd I lived in was my neighbors, my dad, were railroad workers, so I knew what a blue collar community was. So I went to university, lived in dorms, then lived in an apartment building, and then we moved in here for the cheap rent, for the same reason why everybody else ever moved here. And all of a sudden, I felt like this is home. This is like how I grew up. So I really got to like the area. Well, then we found out about the urban renewal plan that the Minneapolis Housing and Redevelopment Authority wanted to do. This was the purpose of federal government and city government to blight, physical blight in houses was like a disease. How do you get rid of disease?
You cut it out.
You cut it out. Right. And that's what they decided to do. This came after the same Minneapolis Housing Redevelopment Authority had cleared away so much of the Gateway area. At the time, is the largest clearance project in the United States. But it had a lot of blight, a lot of disease that had to be gotten rid of. So a lot of buildings got amputated.
Yeah, and so this was, tell me about that, the East Seward, the West Seward plan. What was the plan?
In a way, there was no plan. The Housing Authority considered themselves a land assembly agency. When they clear-cut the Gateway area in downtown Minneapolis, Minneapolis was growing, the city, so all they had to do is make sure that whoever bought the land was fairly responsible to build more of downtown. They used the same lack of imagination over here in Seward West. They created some zoning, and they intended to change these narrow lots into bigger lots, but they really didn't have any criteria or any development objective. And that just scared the people, the young people living here. They just thought, and the older people especially, they thought, I don't want to lose this house for an apartment building. And at that time, just before then, in the Wedge area, where now I'm involved in this, it's Seward West deja vu all over again over there, but they're buying up properties in the Wedge to probably build apartment buildings like they did before. But at any rate, how did I digress? That was the fear, because there had been kind of the sense that the soul of the neighborhood was small houses, This is where people with meager means live, mostly older people, when we moved into the neighborhood. But then this was the 60s generation, still continuing into the 70s. A lot of hippies, counterculture people, on 22nd Avenue, just outside of where we're sitting, Bill, there was a solid hippie from Franklin to East 22nd Street. And they seemed to be, on one hand, the older people, for some reason, didn't mind them. Why? What were the older people doing with their backyards? They're raising vegetables. What were the hippies doing with their backyards? They're raising vegetables. Although sometimes areas of those vegetables were and other materials were bordered by tall corn stalks to kind of hide the crop of their choice.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there. So, but yeah, it's a nice little intergenerational moment, probably right there. That's kind of cool. So yeah, and then there's this redevelopment plan that is put forward basically to bulldoze everything. Is that it? And then people, what happens next? There's kind of a movement against that.
Well, I think what really helped make this area work, other than out serendipity, was that the housing authority had no imagination, and we did. And what we wanted to do, the Vietnam War was reaching its peak at the time. A lot of the young people here, like myself and my wife, were college students, and I can say that I never marched in a protest, but we knew a lot of people that did, and we totally sympathized with them. But we had our own war right here that we decided to take on. So basically, a long story short, we used the rhetoric and actions and in your face and defiance of the anti-war movement to keep the neighborhood. We kind of, the housing authority wasn't able to handle that. They had an area director who was former World War II Marine vet, and he believed in top-down administration of his agency, and he just thought that eventually we'd flunk out of college or graduate and move away. Well, we didn't. We stayed, and we just had the resolve to fight our own war. This was the housing authority that was the enemy, and we had to fight them.
What were some of the slogans that you used or whatever?
Renewal, not removal, was a big one. I made a poster to that regard, but the buttons were all buttons that you could get at any head shop, like resist authority, or question authority, and others like that. But what, on one hand, the anti-war movement used demonstrations, street marches, a lot of shouting and hollering and things like that. And we did very much the opposite. The housing authority had an urban renewal plan. It was about 2.5 inches thick. Now, the bureaucrats who worked in the office, could you really expect them to know every page of that 2.5-inch thick book equally well? It probably didn't happen. But what we in the PAC did, the Project Area Committee, citizens elected through the neighborhood, we found in the plan what we needed to know the most. In this way, it was like guerrilla warfare. We found what we needed to do, and we knew that better than the housing authority.
Like what specifically did you find in there?
I can't remember any specifics, but we, one of the things that I do remember so well, we had a legal aid attorney, Steve Swanson, who really schooled us well on this, and we found the basis for Uber Renewal Plan said that the public agency shall acquire and demolish all of the houses on Milwaukee Avenue. And so we worked hard to change the "and," to excise out the and then replace "or" with that, and then add the word "rehabilitate." So they could acquire and demolish or rehabilitate the houses. Those few words we fought with them for a year over, and we just kind of wore them down.
So that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, that's amazing that you could such a small change would make such a big difference. And then they finally caved in on that. And then what happened? They bought a lot of the property.
They were mandated by their urban renewal plan to buy the property, and they eventually did. Here's the interesting irony. When the PAC group first started, PAC Project Area Committee, we were all renters, and we didn't look into our own futures that much, but out of the sense of social responsibility that young people had, we want to save these houses for the older residents, because they were afraid to move. At a public meeting, I remember one guy stood up and said, "I don't want to be renewed." And but then when the Housing Authority, there was a young congressman at the time named Donald Fraser, congressman in Washington, D.C. He looked at how urban renewal was administered, and he saw that when people were by eminent domain, when their properties were bought, that they were given very little money for relocation benefits. So he mandated a $15,000 grant for people removed from their properties. There was a grant plus to make sure that there were comparable property valuations of what the real estate was worth, and take the highest of two estimates. So all of a sudden, these people who had once said their space heater was good enough, they didn't need a foundation under their house, their plumbing leaked a little bit, but all they had to do when it was really cold is just turn the tap on a little bit to make sure it dripped.
I've done that before in my house. I used to live in an old house that was built by a relative the turn of the century. Did not have a lot of insulation in it.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then all of a sudden these people started to see that they could buy a house south of Lake Street for the same amount of money as they were getting the relocation grant, that $15,000 plus $17,000 or $7,000 for the market value of their house, plus a few thousand dollars for actual relocation moving expenses, which these people did with pickup trucks. So that money got saved. But then they transplanted themselves over on the other side of Lake Street. So the houses that were vacant then, this was a really opportunity for the PAC group. We formed two different nonprofit housing corporations. By this time, we had badgered the Housing Authority enough so that there were certain plans that would give low-interest loans plus grants for houses. At that point, Don Fraser became mayor of Minneapolis, and a lot of neighborhoods, Phillips and Seward West, worked with Fraser to get low-interest loans plus grants for houses.
So, what year did Fraser get elected?
I can't remember. I think it was in... It was Al Hofstede. Al Hofstede. And Hofstede realized that housing rehabilitation was something that the city of Minneapolis needed to address. And Seward West was his model neighborhood for that. And so there was the program for nonprofit corporations formed a neighborhood to rehab houses. Plus, Hofstede initiated what's called the Individual Rehab Program, where individuals could get low-interest loans and grant money from the Housing Authority to rehabilitate a house using carpentry skills that they kind of learned from their next-door neighbor who's rehabbing a house, who learned from somebody else. And there got to be like a communal tool exchange on Milwaukee Avenue plus a rehab house learning from each other, learning the skills.
I think some of the interesting thing about reading your book and looking at it is about if you walk down the street now it's a pedestrian only street with all these trees in the middle and kind of a community spaces in between these porches on either side. So I was really struck because back in the 70s there was cars were driving down the middle of the street, right? And then the other change that was interesting is a lot of the houses maybe didn't have foundations, and then there was significant modification done to them during this rehab process where they were almost completely rebuilt from the inside or something.
Well, we use the term rehab, but a better term was rebuilt, because the houses were stripped of their exterior brick, those that had brick, otherwise wood siding. All the lath and plaster on the inside was thrown into dumpsters, because for practical purposes, the walls needed to be insulated, and to run plumbing and electrical, it just made the cost cheaper if there were bare wall studs to work with. And then there's a matter of the foundations. There's a house mover named Bill Depke, really interesting guy, funny jokes all the time, but he became a service where he would take the beams they used to move houses, and he'd lift up these houses. Then his bulldozer crew would excavate underneath them, and then the contractors would put in footings and a concrete block foundations, lower the house back down, and then start the plumbing and heating, ductwork and various runs, insulation, sheetrock. So the houses are basically new houses using existing framing.
Was it common for houses not to have foundations back in the 1880s?
No, it wasn't. But because William Reagan wanted, he needed that money. He saved a lot of money by just leaving the foundations go just 18 inches into the ground, and it worked. They usually had a cellar, but that was about it, with a really steep stairway.
So tell me about the rehab process.
Well, as I said, a lot of us were college students, and then there was the counterculture of people, and I had grown up a little bit ahead of the hippie generation, and I really was skeptical that a lot of the counterculture could learn which end of a wheelbarrow to pick up. And I think we had one failure out of in the 35 block area, 150 houses are rehab, and we had one failure, and it wasn't a hippie. He was actually a construction worker. So, but the it's sort of like learning from one another, and it's just like a community of rehab, the ones who did the rehab first, they're the ones who had to learn it. And then everybody learned from them. There's a lot of tool sharing, and sometimes parts of houses were traded back and forth, like stair and newel posts and things like that, wood trim.
So can you describe what Milwaukee Avenue looks like today?
It looks like it did when it was built by William Reagan. The interesting thing there is that when the housing authority finally decided to do what we had politically pressured them to do, and we said that we want to save the houses, their survey crews went out and they did a replat of the four blocks around Milwaukee Avenue, and very few property lines actually changed.
What's a replat? What is that?
A plat is establishing a property line, sides, front, and back. And you look at a plat map, and it's a series of rectangles, sometimes with jagged lines to reflect certain things. But so very few properties really got changed from. That's because so many of the houses of the 46 that faced Milwaukee Avenue, I think we saved 35 of them. And various contractors, we found a millwork house in Eastside St. Paul that could crank out or cut out the millwork that these houses normally had. I mentioned those those wide door and window trim with the corner blocks on top. All of a sudden, we got those just fresh out of the lumber company, and so the carpenters install those. So the houses were thoroughly rehabilitated, as I said, and some were done by a nonprofit corporation. Seward Redesign, then was called Seward West Redesign. I did some of them, but I'm about to bring up another topic. Because of the political infighting that was happening within the PAC group and in the neighborhood, Seward Redesign decided not to do any houses on Milwaukee Avenue. And I was all too glad to make sure that they didn't, because I was on the other side. But they did some on 22nd Avenue, and they did do houses in other parts of the neighborhood. But the former PAC president, who became Housing Authority Commissioner and then a council member for a while, Tony Scallon, Tony and myself and some others formed a nonprofit group, housing group, called the Milwaukee Avenue Community Corporation. And we did three different packages of housing, about four or five houses in each one. And then that way we used the various subsidies available to make the difference between what the houses actually cost and what the market value of the houses was at the beginning. For example, 2009 Milwaukee was rehabilitated for about $42,000. But banks were pretty skittish, and realtors and everybody else, that this thing would ever work. And the sales price of that house was $30,700. So the difference was called the rehab write-down. And that was another thing that the Seward West PAC hammered into place with the Housing Authority. We said there has to be a subsidy to underwrite the difference, and we badgered them into it. But by the time the last property was done, it achieved what I called a reverse rehab write-down. We did three units, a three-unit townhouse out of an old former fourplex, and it sold for $8,000. Each of the three units, the total of the three units sold for $8,000 more than the rehab cost. There's another factor here, Bill, that I should have mentioned a long time ago. These battles we had with the Housing Authority were just so constant, and not to mention the battles within ourselves. But Jerry Niedenfeuer, who I mentioned, she decided to write a history paper, and it's called Temporary Home, and it's about how people with very meager means could find a place to rent or live on Milwaukee Avenue, and how it became, and with my help in her writing, describing how the architecture had this interesting common characteristics, she incorporated that into it. And so it's a really interesting paper. And then someone from the Minnesota Historic Society, Charlie Nelson, he was watching to see what was going on. And Charlie worked he was called historical architect for the Minnesota Historical Society, and he had worked to help preserve mansions, churches, famous residences and buildings like that. He was looking for, he thought the new direction in historic preservation should be common people's architecture. One day he happened down Milwaukee Avenue, and his eyes just bulged. Then he went in the PAC office to find out how this was happening, and he talked to Jerry. Jerry handed him her paper. And then he said, we're going to make this a historic district. And so when I came back in the office, Jerry told me about this, and I said, well, we're going to have to let the PAC membership vote on this. And Jerry said, Charlie's already on top of that one. He found out about the political dissension. He said, in this case, citizen participation, which what we stood for, wasn't needed for this. And I said, what? And she said, no. She said, he's going to have a quarterly meeting, and we don't have to tell anybody, and we're going to write a little report, and then he'll submit it to the quarterly review meeting that reviews potential historic buildings, and he'll present it to them. So we did that. We carefully spent some time, Jerry and I and my wife Sally and just one other person, writing this proposal for historic district, really cheesy and basic. Charlie took it to his review group. They approved it, and the next morning he put it in the mail, and it had all the protection of a National Registered District at the point that it was in the mail. And so Charlie told the press about this because he achieved one of his big goals of getting Common Man's History. So he called the press, and the press had a lot of things to say. The next morning, the Housing Authority bureaucrats were having their breakfast, and they opened up to the Minneapolis paper and saw in big headlines, Milwaukee Avenue becomes National Register District. So a lot of breakfast got ruined that morning.
That's can maybe we pause and think about what those houses are like? So one of the things you were talking about is how it's really unusual that most of the time you think about rehabbing, restoring a house, it's a fancy house. It's like a big, probably was upper middle class or higher class sort of place. Like you think of a Queen Anne mansion, or I can think of a million examples, Summit Avenue or whatever. But in this case, what is the square footage of the average house on Milwaukee Avenue? Most of them look, there's kind of a footprint that they all sort of mimic. And then how many rooms are there, and like what's the layout like inside? And it's like a 1.5 story brick house with a porch on the front, very small, closely put together, set together.
The floor plan was fairly small. They were about 1,440 square feet with a first floor and second floor. And the first floor consisted of a small little hallway entrance that also held the stairway to go to the second floor. Small little parlor off of that in front. And then a wide room, wider part of the house, a little bit in back of that. There was a big dining room that was much bigger than the parlor. Then a narrow bedroom, we call it the mother-in-law bedroom, that was 7.5 feet wide by 20, or by 12 feet long. And then the kitchen in back of that, and then the kitchen had a back porch off to its side. And then upstairs, there were basically two bedrooms, a small little hallway, and because the toilet plumbing was outside when these houses were built. But then it got to be fairly easy to put a bathroom right at the top of the stairs and take some space out of one of the bedrooms for that. So that was a basic floor plan for the smaller houses. There were bigger houses that were duplexes, those were basically one bedroom apartments. And then there were other smaller wood frame houses that had almost that same layout. And I think what's important here is that those small footprints were what the counterculture really wanted. They didn't want big houses. That's why historic preservation really helped out save these, because the big mansions weren't at all in the scope of any of the people. When we started to do, when our Milwaukee Avenue Community Corporation did houses, some of the people who bought them were engineers, people who worked for banks, but they wanted to live in the city. And they want to take the bus to work downtown. This is perfect for them.
That sounds like people today. I mean, also the other thing is like $30,000 for a house. That sounds like a pretty good deal, Bob.
Yeah, it was an excellent deal. But I think at first we called it the new affordability, although that term has been reinvented about five times since then. But it was just where somehow we found, either we found the right market, the right market found us, and Then another part of this is that we described 22nd and a half Avenue that William Reagan laid out, and then it became called Milwaukee Avenue. And because that was the nickname it had. But when we started to take political control, that 22-member PAC group, when the first word that someone came about, what do we do with the street? It's like everybody knew that it should become a pedestrian walkway. And there were some people at the time who thought that cars would be obsolete in a matter of 10 years.
I feel that way right now. I don't know how you feel.
I don't think that's quite going to happen, but there'd be a lot less of them from now on. So the idea of a pedestrian walkway seemed to work well with us. And then we also, so that what we did then is that between the facades of the houses on both sides, it's about 51, 52 feet, we made the walkway as a paved area, 14 feet wide, had it jog a little bit so it wouldn't be dead on straight, and then a wider boulevard where trees were planted, and then some sidewalks intersected to connect the sidewalk running along the east side of that right-of-way. So it, and with the trees that now 40 years later are look mature, so it's a very interesting area. And the people have maintained their houses, which is really good. Since after it became a historic National Register site, then the PAC group took another step further and wanted it to have real protection. So the city's Heritage Preservation Commission declared it a local site. That was really important too. Another bit of serendipity here, because the when we replanned these four-block area to have a pedestrian walkway, there had to be a place for cars to park, because we can no longer park them in front of their houses. We created satellite group parking lots on 22nd and 23rd Avenue so that people could walk. There's always a parking space within 110 feet of their back door. But with the Milwaukee Avenue mall or walkway, the paved area plus the boulevard, that was a common space, but somebody had to own it. So again, the Housing Authority at this point was playing ball with us, and we created a set of deed covenants that enabled a homeowners association to own the common spaces while people could have simple mortgages on the individual houses. So with that, with the homeowners association then, they were able to own the common areas, plus had deed covenant power to levy home ownership dues that would go for maintenance, snow plowing and tree trimming, things like that. And the first year we did those payments, they were $7 a month for a homeowner association. And I think now they're about $52, so it's still a modest amount. So everything's working fine, Bill.
Yeah, and you walk down the street now, and it's kind of like entering Mr. Rogers' neighborhood to me. It's just, it's beautiful. And in fact, I feel that way about all Seward. I've had so many just moments where I'm walking down the street, and everybody's got these porches, and it seems just like an amazing urban village in a way, where there's sort of a camaraderie and social ties that are. It's a great Jane Jacobs place, you know.
But oddly enough, none of us knew who Jane Jacobs was, but we followed all her principles. And then another planner, another urban planner, West Coast planner, wrote several books on planning in small environments, Christopher Alexander. And one of his books, his first book came out,
The Pattern Language
came out, I think, in 1970 78, and we had things, grass was already growing and mowed many times in the plane that we had done for making small spaces and making them work. And it just became a success right away. And I was called at the time, you know, a really smart planner. And but with hearing that, I kind of joined an architecture practice with another kind of counterculture practitioner. But I said so many times, like I did 2 days ago, so I went to my office, I put my feet up on the desk, and I waited for the phone to ring for another one to happen.
Sounds like a Philip Marlowe novel.
It took until a month ago for an email to come through to the School of Art, from the School of Architecture, and a group in Northeast Minneapolis wants to do their own version of a Milwaukee Avenue. So we met Monday with Thomas Fisher from the School of Architecture, Dean, some of his staff, some people from the neighborhood, and we kind of looked at what their area was like. I recited some of the stuff that I told you about how it works. Their situations are different, but they want to close off the street, and we talked about how it can't all be done at once. They're going to have to do it without government help to a large extent, unless they could talk their council member, Kevin Reich, into providing some subsidy for some of this that the city should do. And Tom Fisher's point was, Tom, the dean of the School of Architecture, that Minneapolis is facing a lot of expenditure coming up for rebuilding the streets, because pouring concrete and all that work is really expensive. And to create, we found out, I mentioned earlier that the city of Minneapolis had funded in the renewal plan $100,000 to replace Milwaukee Avenue as a street. But when there's half as much concrete as what it needed, and a lot of grass and trees and things like that, it came to about $80,000 at the time. So there's a way of taking streets and doing a commons area, a walkway, that neighbors can do. And if the city were to help provide the difference in estimated cost between concrete and making grand walkways and lawns, that is, I think, a future for a lot of urban neighborhoods.
You don't have to plow it. Plus, there's a huge difference in what those properties are worth, because you're taking space that's used just for cars and you're making it a public space that adds a lot of value to your home and your quality of life just living in that area.
Bill, that's exactly what the School of Architecture staff, they looked into all of this, and they said that all of that is really true, that there really is a substantial reduction in what the city does have to spend. You still have to plow a walkway, but if the homeowners association owns it, like in the case of Milwaukee Avenue, that's what those monthly fees go for. So they hire their own tree trimming, their own snow plowing, their own grass cutting, and it's a lot less when the residents do it than when the city does it.
Now it's a great story, and I'm glad to get in, dive into that. I think this hopefully is inspiring to people who I know today are fighting their own battles about changing a street or saving a building in the neighborhood, and sometimes it seems daunting, but just to hear that this has been going on a long time and that something that might look nice today had to be fought for, you know, like tooth and nail 40, 50 years ago or whatever, I mean, that's great to hear. I like your story a lot.
Well, Bill, it'd be nice to believe that everything that public agencies learned in the 70s from us, from we, the neighborhood, that they still remember. No. In the Wedge neighborhood, it's some of these issues are coming up again. It's the top-down thing where the city council members in those areas know better than the residents. And the residents are smarter than this group of hippies and college idealists that we were. They're a lot smarter. I'm working with them on some projects. They're just brainy, but they're stultified by the people who should know better.
Hey, I'm kind of curious about one of your other interests, Bob. I wanted to ask you about the photography that you do. Because you did an art project, kind of a display. So can you just describe your photographs a little bit?
It ties in with... I'm not... Better watch what I say. I don't want to sound like I'm a one-trick pony. But dealing with older buildings... Really? Who have exterior surfaces that are in buildings that are kind of left behind, as what happens during renewal. This is what my day-to-day architecture work is. But sometimes, all the time, I'm taking a camera with me, and I showed you a photograph here earlier from today, but I'll see buildings here and there that have this kind of distress, but by getting up real close, all of a sudden I can see abstract patterns and textures, and I can make art photographs out of them. And this is what this is one of my things that I do from a serious interest. So it's the same thing I do on the drawing board, I do with my camera.
Yeah, so can you describe, I think I'll post a few of them because they're cool. You know, a lot of, I don't want to call it ruins, but just sort of looking at, sometimes they're old abandoned buildings or whatever, and graffiti that might exist there, or just kind of the way that old buildings sort of have these moments. I don't know. Yeah, it's cool stuff. Like, what are some of your favorite spots to take pictures in town, Minneapolis here?
That's a tough one, Bill. Minneapolis, unfortunately, has spiffed itself up too much. And St. Paul, too. I have to really scratch in order to find them. But Barcelona, Spain, I just came back from. And it's just, there's just a lot of great images from buildings 200, 300 years old that have layers of graffiti, paint, other construction materials left over that I get these images. But there still are ways to look at parts of the built environment, looking at them up close. And sometimes they've aged just enough where there's something that provides a patina, or where a building has earned its age by how it looks.
Do you think there's something that's like irreplaceable about old building materials that we'll just never be able to remake? Or do all things sort of, when they age, become beautiful and meaningful, you know?
That's right, Bill. The older building parts get, the more they take on, as I mentioned earlier, sense of age, but they have their own beauty. And in historic preservation, the job is to make those surfaces and the materials live a little longer. Eventually, they'll all have to be replaced. But by in England and Europe, there's wooden surfaces that have probably lasted 300 or 400 years, and just because the nature of wood is that it can survive a long time if it's properly cared for, and the same with brick and stone. And it's unevenly applied to older buildings, but I think we're seeing. I think historic preservation is a tough act to do in the 70s and after, but there's more of a consciousness, I think, now. Even in the real estate community, you see buildings advertised as historic, which means that they can be charged a lot more for them. So I think we're gonna hang on to our built environment a lot longer, just for a number of factors. Not necessarily related to historic preservation.
Yeah, it's kind of a big cultural shift for a place like in the United States. It's thinking back to the 50s, where just anything old was bad and anything new was good, and you just tore the city down, and you talk about the Gateway as an example, but that's just the American way, you know, is to be living in the future all the time, you know, and I think, you know, there's that's shifting. hopefully. But yeah, without a, I don't know. So that's it's great. I think Milwaukee Avenue is a great example of the potential that exists in valuing our past and having it be part of our present and our environment. So I don't know. Thanks for your work on that, Bob, and for your other passions and active. Do you live in the neighborhood here?
Well, we did live in the neighborhood on Milwaukee Avenue before the renewal. And then the political battling, infighting between two parts of the PAC group were so intense that my wife couldn't stand it, so we moved to St. Paul for a while. And then I still kept working for the as a volunteer for the PAC group, for the membership and the staff assisting them. And a lot of the stuff that the planning for the four-block area got laid out on my drawing board late at night on Marshall Avenue in St. Paul. But then it seemed like the time was right to move back, and my wife wanted to really come back because all of her friends were here. And then it was time to implement all of our planning. And the infighting just came right back, and it got really, really vicious. Somehow the right side won, I think.
So if you have there's a lot of young people who are passionate about cities who listen to this podcast, what would you tell them about the value of historic preservation in Minneapolis today? And then I guess we'll just wrap that up after that.
I'm trying to remember.
Well, there's a saying when people would hear what I was doing, and people who are just very workaday, common people, and they'd say, yeah, you're right. They don't bill them like they used to. Bill, the reason why preservation is so important is because they don't bill them like they used to.
And that's why we need to keep what we have.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Can cities still change, though? I mean, because I think there's a lot of frustration about not having enough density to support the kind of fabric and transit and local businesses that you want to see in a city like Minneapolis. I mean, you go to Barcelona and that density is there, and it's hard to see that coming without new apartments being built, right?
Well, I think that you're right, Bill, and this is the kind of the crux of some of the conflict in the Wedge neighborhood right now, because members of the city council... Oh, now I get a chance to stand on the soapbox again. Members of the city council, they're in love with what they learned at the Humphrey Institute about transit-oriented development. So you take properties near where there's bus lines and future streetcar lines, and you increase the density there. How do you do it? You take out properties that are less dense in that area. And this is where... a property 2320 Colfax. It might be demolished right now as we're talking, but the neighborhood fought hard for that and lost because the courts, the city council member of that ward, and other city council members just think that we need, that they are right in keeping the density of the city.
Interesting.
So, in some respects, the values of city leaders have changed, but in some respects, it amounts to the same thing. There are ways of still increasing density on vacant land in various parts of the neighborhood. At 2320 Colfax, in the house next door, we did a study that built some medium density housing on the generous backyards of that property. There's plenty of ways of taking some larger buildings. This has been done all the time. Warehouse buildings turned into offices and lofts are a prime example. But there's ways to do change, and with historic preservation has to provide, and almost always does, a vehicle for people to make it change, to make it more livable, to meet contemporary living needs. One of the residents of Sid Berg of Milwaukee Avenue for a long time, Sid Berg, historian that he is, I use the saying every week from since 1976. He said, history is the record of change.
And that's certainly true in Milwaukee Avenue because of the, you look at a picture from 1968 or whatever, and it's unrecognizable. Well, the buildings are still recognizable. So much has changed. I think about Nicollet Island is another example where you walk around Nicollet Island today, you think like, oh, this is unchanged since 1920. Actually, it's very different than it looked like in 20 or 1960 or, you know, and then when they moved all the houses there. History is a record of change. I like that. Anyway, I want to wrap it up, Bob, and just really, thank you for your awesome book. What's the name of the book again?
It's called Milwaukee Avenue. What's the subtitle here now?
You wrote it.
Yeah, Community Renewal in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and it's a great read. I think it's probably a must read for anyone who lives in the city and cares about urban history or urban politics. And
yeah, you can buy it at any independent bookstore in a Barnes & Noble. And then there's always that trunk of my car.
Great. And anyway, thanks, Bob, and keep up the good work, and I wish you best of luck and whatever.
Well, Billy really pulled out some, I think, great thoughts for me. Maybe a little bit of foolishness here and there, too, but I really enjoyed our session here. I thank you a lot for this interview.
Great. Okay, have a good one.
Cool.
Listening to the Streets.mn podcast, please consider donating to Streets.mn. If you appreciate this podcast and would like to see it improved in the future, just a few dollars is really, really helpful. In the meantime, so long from Minneapolis's Milwaukee Avenue.